Hello, I'm Kieran Vowley.
And I'm Kate Vowley.
And this is Friday Night at Blockbuster, the podcast about our favorite movies from the 2000s. Before we get into this week's movie, though, last week we sort of did a bit of a catch-up on things that I've been watching recently, namely Shogun.
The one thing, really.
The one big thing I've been watching recently. What about yourself? What have you been watching recently? What have you been enjoying recently?
So this week I got to go check out One Life, the new Anthony Hopkins movie.
Yeah.
Once again, at our local playhouse here. Oh my God, it's such a beautiful story. So, if people haven't heard about it, it was on my radar last year. I saw a trailer for it and immediately turned to Mom and was like, that's a movie for me and you. We're going to go check that one out. But it's about a British man in the late 1930s who went to Czechoslovakia, mainly Prague, and found mainly Jewish kids and Jewish families living in their neighborhoods and the slums at the time, just before kind of Hitler came in, and was just like, we need to get these kids out of here. Like, it's not safe for them at all. And started to do that, basically. And so started to get travel visas for them and foster families in England, and had to raise, I think it was £50 for each kid for all of this paperwork, and got 669 kids out of Prague before Hitler invaded and everything had to stop. I was interested to see how they were going to tell the story. I didn't know if they were going to do it in a chronological order, him as a young man and then him as an older man and things like that, or was it going to be an older man reflecting back? And that's kind of the way they ended up doing it. Something would happen in his life and he would think back to a particular kid or a little bit of the time there and things like that. And yeah, I just thought Anthony Hopkins did a great job, because you could totally see that this is a guy who wanted to do more and just couldn't, and like always then lived with the thought that he could have done more.
But there is a very famous, because I remember this trailer too, and there's a very famous clip of, I think it was sometime in the 70s or maybe early 80s or something like that, where he was on one of these sort of daytime talk shows or whatever. He was a guest in the front row. And the, I think they were, they talking about his story or were they talking about somebody else's story?
So yeah, they were talking about his story.
Yeah.
So him and the other people on his little group that were working together had kept a scrapbook of different pamphlets that they had sent out, or photos of all of the kids, because they had to send out photos to try and get foster care for them. And he was showing somebody else. He wanted to do something with it. He didn't want to just get rid of it. And so he was trying to get into a library or a museum or different things. And somebody was like, oh, I might know somebody who's interested in this. Can I hold on to it? And he's like, yeah, sure. And so then he was brought on to the talk show for, I think it was coming up to an anniversary of that time. And they were like, oh, we just need you to come in to fact check. Like, we're going to be talking about it. If we say something wrong, just flag us down and we'll stop the show. And then, yeah, they ended up doing the whole piece on him and his scrapbook. And they ended up finding some of the kids who are now adults.
Yeah.
Or late adults, I guess. Some of them had grandkids by this point. And they had invited all of them onto the show. And so they do the, I think you're talking about the raise your hand if anybody owes their life basically to him.
didn't it started with the person sitting right beside him, and they sort of went to, I think it was a woman, and they go to her first, and they sort of say to him, like, you'll never guess, but like the woman sitting right beside you was one of the kids that you saved. And they have a little moment, I think, together. And then the host of the show just says, is there anybody else in the audience who was, you know, brought over by this gentleman? And everybody else in the audience stands up, and you can just see on his face. And from what I remember, like, the trailer was basically that scene, that moment, because that's the moment from the TV show, basically. And so, okay. You guys both said it was very, very sad.
It is very sad, but the story is sad. And I just kind of found, they, like, let you be in that sad moment. They didn't try and make anything happy. They just let you be sad, if that makes sense. Just been a lot of sad movies this week for me, too. So.
Well, what else? Anything else? I mean,
so I've been watching that, and then I've been watching a documentary on Netflix called The Program.
No, I don't know this one.
So it's a 3-part documentary. It's set down in the States, and it was kind of in the early 2000s, late 90s, early 2000s. It's kind of set. It's basically parents having sent their kids away to this program. I think it's Ivy Ridge is what it's called. And some of the kids were sent because they had been drinking. Some had been doing drugs. Some had quite literally been doing nothing. But their parents had heard good things about the program, so sent them there. And they ended up getting abused and tortured and have now PTSD and all of these things. So, yeah, that's also been a tough watch. I've had to break that one up over a few days. Like, I can't watch it back to back.
Why are you spending time watching that?
Because it's a good story. And once again, it's one of the girls who got out of the program who's come back and has kind of dedicated her life to understanding why the adults that were there stayed. Like, she's gone and talked to a few of them, and they're like, we knew what we were doing was wrong, but we also knew we needed the paycheck, and, like, the town that they were in wasn't a very wealthy town, so they're like, if we had turned away this business, we wouldn't have found another job, and then we would have been out on the street. Like,
it's a pretty bad defense. I don't think that's going to hold up.
And so...
So I needed the money, so I abused kids.
So, like I said, I need some happy movies going forward in a little bit, because between One Life, The Program, and then the movie that we actually did for this week's episode, it's, yeah, I need something happy and cheery.
I might have one for you.
Oh, boy. Okay.
So, last night, I watched for the first time ever Dangerous Liaisons, which, if people know or don't know or whatever, like, the movie Cruel Intentions from the 90s with Sarah Michelle Gellar and Reese Witherspoon and all that sort of stuff,
yes,
is based on the same book that Dangerous Liaisons is based on. Dangerous Liaisons just came out in the 80s. And, like, the very obvious difference, the very obvious comparison was that Dangerous Liaisons is made for adults and Cruel Intentions is made for teenagers. So Dangerous Liaisons gets to be, like, way more depraved. And so at points... it's, like, much more cruel because once you get out of the high school setting, they're not just trying to, like, destroy somebody's reputation.
Yeah.
They're actually trying, like, they'll be like, no, there's a chance I'll kill you. Like,
oh my God,
okay. I'm going to destroy your life systematically. I'm going to break you down and sort of gaslight you to the point of no return. Whereas I find Cruel Intentions is a little bit like, people are going to laugh at you. You know what I mean? So I understand that it's doing its own thing, and it is quite a fun movie as well. But the thing that I think I responded to so much was that because it's so depraved, it's actually quite funny, because the scheming in it, you're just like, holy Christ, like, these people are absolute monsters. But they're also, like, John Malkovich and Glenn Close are so good that you're kind of like, God, these people are awesome. Like, I would never, ever want to cross them. I would never, ever want to be in their crosshairs. But at the same time, just watching them, like, as two characters and two performers, it's absolute dynamite.
It was great.
It's absolute dynamite. Okay. And so it was so funny. But then there were parts where I was like, holy Christ, like, they're really going for it here. But yeah, like, it's been on my watch list forever. And I finally sat down and watched it last night. And I was like, oh, that is fantastic.
So have you watched the Cruel Intentions recently? Like, do you tend, if you know that their stories are kind of linked, do you tend to try and watch them close together?
No. I like, I've seen Cruel Intentions before. I've seen it a couple times over the years at parties and shit like that. I don't really need to see it again. Like, I don't feel the need to see it again. You know what I mean? There was obviously quite a bit of overlap. Like, they both come from the same novel. And so I was able to sort of put things together last night and sort of be like, oh, this person is this person. And that, you know, this
kind of event, make the connections.
This event will lead to this, will lead to that, will lead to this. But because they're working in, like, two different tones, it was still fresh enough
yeah.
that I wasn't just sitting there being bored by the fact that I knew this entire story.
Okay.
So yeah, it's definitely one to check out. Like, it's period piece, it's set in France before the revolution, all sort of stuff. So like, it looks incredible, all the costumes and shit like that. And like the sort of opening shot over the credits is the two main characters just like getting dressed. And you're just like, going back to our conversation about Marie Antoinette, it's like such a production,
yeah,
just to get dressed, to go over and sit on somebody's couch and talk. You're just like, holy my God. Like,
I would never go anywhere.
Yeah, like, this is way too much effort. But yeah, it was really good. Really enjoyed it. Really, really loved it.
Okay.
And as you said, yes, the movie that we're talking about this week, which we can jump into now in a second, like, Dangerous Liaisons was a nice sort of tonic.
Yeah.
To sort of be like, ooh, okay, let's get that out of the system.
Yeah, I was going to say, I need something soon, so.
The movie that we are here to talk about this week, going back to March 27th, 2007, Children of Men, the dystopian, futuristic sci-fi movie. Before we get into the movie.
Okay.
Let me just make one joke.
Oh, boy.
About the movie, and then we can move on to the serious talk, because this is a very serious movie.
Okay.
There's very little humor in it whatsoever.
Yeah.
But in a world where no child has been born for 18 years.
Yeah.
There are no children. The population is kind of dying from like the bottom up.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? I was sitting there being like, a world with no children? Sounds like paradise. Sounds like absolute heaven.
You can't say that now with Briar in your life. She looked at you today over the breakfast table and said, I love you, uncle. Like, come on.
After saying that she loved herself first. Loves herself first, then loves me, and then didn't say it to anybody else.
Yeah, like, yeah. Come on.
And then I ate her breakfast.
Yeah.
She wasn't eating it. But yes, turning our attentions to Children of Men.
In the more serious tone.
No more joking. That's it. No more. Last week, I said that lots of people and lots of lists out there would have this as one of the best movies of the entire decade.
Yeah, which surprised me.
Surprised you, but did you look into that at all?
No, I totally forgot. Did you?
Thank God one of us is doing the job here. So you said that you wanted to start here. And so like,
yeah,
we might as well start here, sort of lay the groundwork of how good this movie is. Because I think we both agree that it is very good.
Yeah, and I think I couldn't remember last week. I have seen it before.
Yeah.
And I had actually logged it before. So it was when I got Letterboxd and stuff like that. So
it was within the last few years.
Last few years. Yeah. So I think both of us went and looked at my original review. And I think even in that one, I talked about people say that this is great and this is one of the best movies. And I couldn't quite understand it then either. So I think this is a good starting point.
But do you not think that this is a very good movie?
No, I still think it's good movie.
Oh, okay.
I just don't know if I would have it
that highly ranked. Okay.
So
it's tough. It's not necessarily one of my favorite movies, but every time I do watch it, and I haven't probably watched it for many, many years, like even more than the last time you watched it. It's probably 6 or 7 years since I've seen it. Like, it's not really the most fun movie to go back to.
No.
So it is one of those movies where I think you sort of maybe have to separate entertainment value from what is on the screen, like what they were able to do. And then we'll get into sort of what it all means in a bit. But yeah, just looking at the rankings. So these were a couple of things that I found. The BBC in, I think, 2016.
Okay.
Released, they went to like, I think like 120 critics or filmmakers or whoever, and got them to rank, I think, their 10 favorite or their 5 favorite or whatever it was. This ranked 13th from the last 100 years.
Oh, wow. Okay.
So 1916 to 2016, this ranked number 13. Time in, I think, 2023 released a 100 best movies of the last 100 years. And this was in there. I don't know if it was necessarily like ranked. Like, I don't think they had a, like, this is the best movie.
They just had, this is the 100 that you need to.
This is just the 100 best
that you should check out, kind of. Okay.
And then from 2006, when the movie was originally released, it's on 21 major best of lists.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Like top 10, top, you know what I mean? Yeah. Best movies of the year. 21. So like
Jesus.
Highly, highly regarded movie. Almost like, I think like what I wanted to show there was that like in 2006, people were like, oh, this is one of the best movies. And we've continued to feel that way.
It's still kind of in that
since
talk.
Okay. 2006. You know what I mean? 17 years later, I would actually maybe argue it's even better because of how things have turned out in the real world. So, yeah. Good movie. Good movie.
And I think, like you said, for me, my reviews and the way I rank and I look at movies is very much tied into, like, entertainment value. I can start to separate, and I've started to now that we've done a lot more of these episodes and things like that, my entertainment versus, like, the quality of it.
Yeah, yeah.
But yeah, I don't know if I would have it ranked that high, because for me, the entertainment of it isn't necessarily there. I can enjoy it, and I can appreciate what they've done, but am I looking to go back and rewatch this again next year? Like, is it going to be a yearly rewatch? Probably not. But I think it's also because I'm just terrified of the content of the movie.
Well,
so.
yeah, like, that's the thing, right? Like, so for myself, I have this at number 27 of my favorite 50 for the decade. Because it's sort of like, there's no denying how good it actually is and what they're able to do. But at the same time, it is like, God damn it, like, this is pulverizing.
Yeah. It's a bleak outlook on the world.
Yes.
So
for anyone who doesn't know or hasn't seen Children of Men for a very, very long time, it is this slightly futuristic at this point. Like, it's only, I think it's 2027.
Yeah, so it's 3 years for us.
Yes, yes. It was 21-ish years when they made it. But it is this future where the world has become infertile and no babies have been born for 18 years. And because of that, the, like, it's really fascinating what they're able to do. Because, like, because there's no children being born, they just, like, close ranks.
Yeah.
And you get the sense that, like, the countries around the world have, I think there's also a bit, we hear about a flu pandemic, which, you know.
Yeah, COVID.
We've all gone through at this point.
Yeah.
But you get the sense that, like, the USA and this movie set in England and, you know, countries in Europe and China and whoever just, like,
closed borders,
ranks, looked out for themselves. And so what you end up having then is haves and have-nots. And so we're plunged into this world that has had no children born for 18 years, has gone through a flu pandemic that wiped out however many people, are going through a major refugee immigrant situation, and you're just like, welcome. Like, welcome to the world of Children of Men.
Well, I think for me, if they had picked one thing, like if they had picked the world doesn't have any more kids because of infertility or the refugee immigrant crisis, I would have been like, oh, good start to a movie. Like, that's your big problem that the world is having right now.
Yeah.
But the fact that they've done both in one movie is just like, oh, you're just giving us no hope in this movie. Like, there's no silver lining, maybe a bright spot, light at the end of the tunnel. No. Just the world is shit. Like,
and this is the world in which Clive Owen operates. He is our main character. He's kind of sleepwalking through life at this point. We don't really know too much about him. We eventually learn more as the movie goes along. But yeah, he's basically sleepwalking through life until he is roped in to this mission with a sort of like semi-terrorist group, semi-environmental, semi-pro-refugee.
Yeah. Freedom fighter.
Yeah. Like, they're kind of mixed up in a lot of different things, I guess, depending on who your news source is. But he gets roped in with them because they have a young woman that they need to get out of the country.
Yeah.
There is this potential beacon of light called, I think they're called the Human Project.
Yes. Yeah.
And they have some island somewhere and there's a boat leaving to go to this island and they need to get this young woman onto this boat. But to do that, they need travel papers, and Clive Owen's character has connections to get these travel papers.
Yeah, cousin or
he has a cousin.
Something.
Yeah, cousin in the government, and he can maybe get these travel papers, get her on this boat, get her out of here. he doesn't really know what's going on. He kind of doesn't care what's going on.
No, he's kind of reluctant at first. He thinks that they're kind of dumb in wanting to try and help this woman. Like,
he doesn't get it. He's totally in it for the money.
Yeah.
They said they'll pay him however, I think it's like $5,000 or something like that. And then he sort of says, well, if I'm going to do this, I need more. And so he sort of negotiates for more and more money. And that's kind of what he cares about. And then we'll get into some things, but we eventually find out that the young woman is pregnant with the first baby. And his whole outlook on the situation flips.
Yeah.
And it's then like, fuck, we need to get this lady out of here.
Yeah, well, because he gets brought in by this terrorist group who you find out is run by his ex-wife.
Yeah.
Who you then slowly get to piece their life together. And you realize that they had a son who died in this flu pandemic. And you kind of see that they've clearly split. He went almost zombie-like.
Yeah.
Just... I get
completely
up,
apathetic.
Yeah, yeah. I get up, I go to work, I do my job, I come home, and that's the end of my day. Maybe I go out and hang out with the friends that live out in the woods.
Yes, yeah. Michael Caine will get to. Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Maybe I go hang out
with Michael Caine in this movie.
Maybe I go hang out with him, but like, I don't do anything. I don't kind of rock the boat. And his ex-wife is there being like, nope, we need to make this world better. Whatever we can do to help it, we're going to do. And so
she becomes super militant in terms of,
And so, the minute he finds out that Key, the young woman, is pregnant, he's there then being like, nope, we got to save this baby. Like, I don't know who this baby is. I have no relation to this baby, but this is the hope that the world now needs.
Yeah. Yeah.
So let's get Key out of here.
And we'll get into sort of their journey along the way. But before we get into all that, I just want to ask, you've talked about the fact that sci-fi is one of these genres that you do have a hard time
kind of connecting with.
Connecting with, immersing yourself in, with something like Children of Men, where it's obviously sci-fi, it's obviously dystopian, but because it's set in our world and because it's set at a time where it's like, it's not that distant, is that easier for you?
Yeah, extremely. So because I can kind of... As much as we hate that I do it sometimes, I can kind of put myself in the movie in a little bit. The sci-fi where, the 2001 Space Odyssey sci-fi.
Where it's it's out there.
Abstract. Too abstract, right. Too out there for me. Whereas this, the fact that it's set in London and we see the Statue of David at one point and we see some of the landmarks, I can be like, oh, I could see this happening. Hopefully not in, 3 years time for us.
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
But
you never know. You never know.
But yeah, I find it easier to kind of grasp because there's some reality. There's something for me to kind of hold on to.
I think what I enjoyed, and this starts the first scene of the movie where he goes into the coffee shop and then there's the bomb explosion. Talk about a way to start your movie. But I think what you can immediately see is that it's set in London or the opening scenes anyways are set in London before they sort of go off on this journey. And it's it's familiar. I don't know what street that is, but I've been to London and I've walked down streets that look exactly like that.
Yeah. You got the little coffee shops. You got the little convenience stores.
You've got the old world stone buildings right beside sort of newish stuff going on. I think what's interesting with Children of Men is that because we've gone 18 years with no children, you can look at the world and identify that even though people are still going to work, even though people are still falling in love and all this normal things are happening, there's also a level of decay that has just set in where it's sort of nobody cares.
Yeah.
We've got 50, 60 years left. So the buildings are a little bit run down. The technology is a little bit run down. They're not innovating. They're not improving anymore. And so there's this level of rust and dirt and grime to sort of everything.
Yeah.
Where you're just even though that looks super familiar, it's also
a little different. Yeah.
It's also foreign. It's also different. And to put your sci-fi into something like that. I was just like, oh, that's a really cool way of introducing these ideas, because normally with sci-fi, it is futuristic. It is high tech, but this is like, it's a little dirty. You can feel it like under your fingernails. I like it. I like it. It makes the world more immersive.
Yeah. I liked that. Like, he's driving through London at one point, and like you said, people are kind of going on about their lives, but they also just don't care. So like, there's a whole quartet or like a whole band playing out in like a park, and all of a sudden like a zebra walks by, like somebody's walking their pet zebra. Yeah. And it's probably like, yeah, because the zoo's probably closed.
Yeah.
Like, there's no kids going to the zoo, so they probably sold off animals to people as pets. Like, sure.
there's obviously a lot of little touches, like one of the first scenes or whatever it was, and he's on traveling on the train.
Yeah.
And so you obviously get the sense that, like, because society in some ways has shut down, the sort of disparity between people who have money or people who have privilege versus people who don't is like widening, and it's getting bigger and bigger and bigger. And so one of the things they do is there are obviously encampments or whatever, sort of just lining wherever they can find space there. That's where they're going. And one of the spots is obviously along these train tracks. And so instead of making new and improved trains, they've just put up these like metal screens on the window.
Yeah.
So that the things that people throw at the trains don't hit the windows.
Yeah.
And you're sort of like, oh, that's the solution. Like, we're not trying to make things better. We're just going to modify things that we've already got to get us through the day.
Yeah.
And you're just like, man, like, that would be tough. Like, I can't imagine. But at the same time, like, this movie does such a good job where you're sort of like, no, that all makes sense. Like, who out there would be trying to design
the newest thing, the best thing.
Yeah. If it's not going to be around, like, it doesn't matter. So yeah, I think like watching this the other night, I was struck by like how this was like the anti Blade Runner. And so like, you haven't seen Blade Runner.
Yeah, I was going to say, I don't know what you mean, but continue. So somebody has.
Somebody definitely has. So Blade Runner is often, it's another one of these sci-fi set movies, but again, it's set in like the not too distant future, and especially now, but at the time I think it was like 1980s or whatever, and then it was set in 2029, I think. And basically what that movie has achieved is that like everything after Blade Runner, every like sci-fi movie after Blade Runner looks like Blade Runner.
Okay.
You know what I mean? Like, there's a little bit, it's a little bit like space movies with 2001, where it's like, that's the movie you're clearly looking at to do your stuff as well.
Yeah.
We can all see the connections. And so any sort of sci-fi movie does kind of look like Blade Runner. But this is like the absolute inverse of it. So like Blade Runner is all like neon lights and high tech, and it's still grimy and still dirty, especially what you get in that movie is like levels. And so the closer you are to the ground, the dirtier things are. But as you go higher at like similar to society, things get cleaner, things get nicer, things get more expensive, to the point where I think the richest person in the movie quite literally lives in the top of a pyramid. And you're sort of like,
symbolism
is quite obvious at that point. But this is just like, it's like nothing works in this movie. Like, cars are breaking down all the time, and you know, the technology doesn't really work, and things are patched together. Whereas in Blade Runner, it's quite functional. Like, everything is working. And so I was just kind of blown away that like Alfonso Cuarón made a movie in the lineage of Blade Runner, but found a way to sort of be like, but we're doing this over here.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Do you want to talk about Cuarón at all? Because he's former Harry Potter director. He's kind of one of your guys. He must be, right?
Must be. But I didn't kind of recognize his name. And so before we started recording, I was like, what else has he done? But yeah, so he's done the Harry Potter, which was at the time my favorite book, not necessarily my favorite movie out of the series, but my favorite book.
What's your favorite movie of the Harry Potter series?
Number 6.
What's that one?
Half-Blood Prince.
That's your favorite movie?
Yeah, I think that was my favorite movie.
I think that's quite low on a lot of people's lists.
I know.
Isn't it?
I think we've already gone through this.
Okay.
in my...
Number three would be my favorite movie and favorite book.
Okay.
Prisoner of Azkaban, yeah.
Yeah.
Which is the one that he did.
Is that also the last book, though, that you read?
No, no, I've read them all now.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, I've read them all.
Okay.
Yeah.
And then I saw Gravity
as yes.
well. But
yes.
That's the end of my...
Alfonso Cuarón experience?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So.
He's done a couple others. He did Roma there a couple years ago, which... Looking back on it now, probably should have won Best Picture and all that sort of stuff. Yeah, like it probably is the best movie of that year. The one that he did that I remember watching was this Mexican set movie called Y Tu Mama Tambien.
Okay.
I remember watching that by myself on a Christmas day where I was like, I was alone. There was nobody around. That's when I was living in Kingston.
I was going to say, we all abandoned
and
you.
And you all abandoned me for Christmas. And so I just remember, I didn't really know what it was.
Yeah.
But it's a very, very highly regarded. And so I remember renting it and ordering a huge pizza and just sitting there and eating it. And it's basically a movie about these two younger men going on a road trip with this older woman and then basically falling into like a throuple situation. And it's like
very
sexual and like...
And you were sitting there eating your lunch.
I was just sitting there eating pizza by myself on Christmas being like, oh, this is not what I expected at all. But it's very good. It's a really good movie. But yeah, he's kind of one of these directors where I think like the first part of his career, you can go back and look, he made like four or five movies in the first 10 years. And since Children of Men, which is 2006, 2007, he's made two movies.
Yeah.
And you're like, could you make some more, please? Like,
is he like one of your?
He's not one of my favorites because he doesn't have the filmography,
catalog.
He doesn't have the catalog yet, but he does make these movies. Even like Gravity, which I wasn't completely won over by. I do remember seeing that in the movie theater, being like, "This is pretty special." Like on the big screen and everything like that. I was like, "Holy shit, this is pretty wild." But yeah, like he's clearly good. So I want him to make more things because that would hopefully mean more good movies.
What I find kind of interesting is just like the few that I've seen, they're all kind of different.
Yes.
Like he's not always in a dystopian futuristic world, or he's not always in this kind of world. He does maybe just do whatever like appeals to him at the time based off of the script or like whatever it is. And, like, I kind of find that interesting in directors sometimes because you can never predict then what they're going to do next.
Well, I think
good or bad.
Yes.
But
yeah. I think, and like, this Children of Men as compared to Gravity, like, you could lump them both into a sort of sci-fi genre, but they're very different.
Yeah.
They're very different. Like, they would not sort of be a one-to-one thing there. So I think with Children of Men, I don't know if this is true, but I think it probably is true, is that he did Harry Potter to get this movie made.
Probably.
He probably wanted to make this movie. He probably had the idea for this movie. It's based on a book. Like, he'd probably read the book and all this sort of stuff. But who's going to give the money to somebody to make a movie like this? Because it's very intense.
Yeah.
And it's, you know, there's not a lot of sunshine in this movie.
No.
And so I wonder if the conversation was like, sure, we'll, you know, we can give you the money, but you got to do this thing over here first. And so he goes and knocks out a Harry Potter movie. And then 2 years later, turns around with Kingdom or Children of Men. You're just like, oh God, like,
yeah,
this is makes sense. This is the register he should be working in.
Yeah.
So I think what I got the other night too was there's clearly he has like a firm grasp of the sort of tone and the vision. Because this movie, well, now I'm curious to ask, like, at what point do you find the movie become almost too intense and then, like, not let you go? Because, like, it does start with the explosion. And so for me, like, that's like a moment of, like, this is where this movie's going. Even though we're starting here, this is the first scene. Like, danger is always around the corner. But for me, it's when they're attacked on the road.
Yeah.
From that moment on, this movie does not let you breathe, basically.
Yeah, I was kind of looking back again, trying to, like, remember the order of the things sometimes. And yeah, I would say in and about that, once he meets up with them and he has the papers.
Yeah.
And they're like, okay, we're going to drive you to Brex Hill or wherever they're going.
Yeah, it's like some encampment or something like that. Yeah, yeah. I don't think it's an actual place.
Yeah, wherever they were going. That's the moment. Because then at the start of the movie, he meets them or he's taken by them. And then he's released. And then he goes and meets somebody else. At that point in the movie, when he's in the car with them going to this encampment, he's only with those people now.
Yeah.
Like, he's only with...
Yeah, he's in this world now.
He's in this world now. And so that's when I'm just like, oh, okay, like, he's in the world, we're in the world.
Yeah.
That's it. Yeah. So...
I think, yeah, like, once the attack comes, which, like...
Jesus Christ, that was a fucking terrifying attack.
What a scene. Because the way that he shoots it all, where he's in the car and it's, you know, the camera's sort of roaming around the car, you don't see what happens until...
Too late.
Chiwetel Ejiofor, who's driving the car, you just hear him off camera be like, Jesus Christ.
Yeah.
And the camera turns around, and that's when you see a flaming car come down to block the road and just people streaming down the hill at their car and attacking. Yeah. And that's when you're just like, holy fuck, like, where do these people come from?
Where do these people come from? What, like, what in the car? Because at this point, we don't know. What in the car are they trying to get? Like, are they just trying to get the car? Like,
Are they just, like, marauders and they're just out there for damage?
Yeah, like, you don't know. And so then them getting away and the bit of the car chase with the motorcycle and Julianne Moore, you know.
Yes. She unfortunately does come to an end there. He shoots that all in one take, in one shot.
Right? Okay.
Like there's no editing in that sort of, in the entire car ride and then the attack until they're sort of, I think it's when they are stopped by the police.
Yeah.
There then is an edit. Normally, so like the whole like long one take thing is kind of film broed out of existence. Like, you know what I mean? Like
it's not a thing anymore?
No, it's just like... It's talked about to death. Like, you know what I mean? It can be impressive. It can be great. We're going to talk about a movie in a few weeks that has a really, really great one, like long one take. I find that sometimes people get like too over-enthusiastic about it sometimes. Like, editing exists for a reason. Okay. Sometimes it's a good reason. But in a case like this where you're using it to ratchet up intensity.
Yes.
I find it works really, really good because you're not letting us
have that break.
Yeah, you're not letting us out of the moment.
Yeah.
We're sitting in the car as it's being attacked. And the addition to that is we were sitting in the car 2 minutes ago when they were firing ping pongs at each other and having a good time and telling jokes. So like we've gone from that moment to this moment where there's a motorcyclist with a gun chasing us down and we haven't left the car.
Yeah.
And I find like, when it's used like that, when it's used like Karan does in this movie, you're just like, oh my God, like that's how you do a long oneer.
Yeah, because I think if there had been any kind of cut or if we had done a scene maybe behind the motorcyclist and like we were looking into the car, you would have that moment of like, oh, I could take like a really quick breath.
Yeah.
Like I can, okay, I can exhale for a second. But because he doesn't do that, you are there just being like, are we going to get out of this? Are we going to live? Like,
and like, I just love the way too, like, There are times where you don't want to be conscious of the fact that there's a camera there.
Yeah.
And so sometimes, you know, again, not to give future episodes away, but next week we're doing one where like it's accused of being maybe too shaky. This movie has quite a few scenes and quite a few moments where like the blood splatter sits on the camera lens.
Yeah.
And sometimes and normally I would find that very distracting. Because you're sort of like, well, it's obviously a camera.
Yeah.
And the blood hit the camera and they just don't want to wipe it off or whatever. But again, in this movie, the way that he, because of the way that he frames it all, I was sitting there being like, oh, that's blood on my face.
Yeah.
You know, and then it looks around and there's blood on everybody else's face. And so again, it just puts you in that environment where you're just like, holy fuck, I'm sitting right there. Which then makes you even more terrified of what's happening.
I find... Up until probably the last kind of set of the movie, like when they're in the...
Refugee camp. Yeah.
I can kind of be like in the movie and out of the movie at the same time and stuff. Like I feel like I'm in it, but I know I'm not. it's that last bit where they're running through like the little town and stuff, and he's chasing
another long-oner.
A long-oner.
Yeah.
That's when I'm just like, oh, I'm just another person on the ground with them. Like, I am chasing after him. I'm trying to get her. I'm following this person. Like, that's when I'm like in the movie. And I think I felt that the first time I watched it too. I was just, and I think it's because the camera is not steady. It's not just like smooth and stuff. It is that bit shaky. It is that bit bumpy because the ground is bumpy and shaky.
Yeah.
And
yeah. No, so it's used really effectively. The way he uses the camera is really, really effective in this movie. And, like, that's what I kind of mean. Like, he's obviously a really great filmmaker. So just make more stuff. Like, I don't even care what it's about. Obviously, I'll watch this and be happy. I'll watch you having a road trip with a thruple and be happy. Make whatever you want. I don't care. Just make more movies. So we get out of that moment. And we sort of say, like, the movie doesn't let you breathe. There are obviously moments. He knows, he understands pacing. He understands, like,
yes,
that was intense. We need to, you know, bring the temperature down a little bit.
So they go off to a safe house.
They go off to a safe house. Turns out to be not that safe.
No.
Especially for Clive Owen.
Yeah.
This is where he finds out that she's pregnant. Until this moment, did you have any clue before then about Key?
No. So I think the first time I watched it, the beginning of the movie with the bomb, the news is being broke that the youngest person alive, this, it's a boy.
Baby Diego
is dead.
Yeah, he's been killed.
He's been killed.
Yeah.
He was kind of a bit of a celebrity because he's the youngest person alive. I then thought, oh, Key must be the new person.
Oh, the new youngest person.
The new youngest person. Because I think they mentioned in the news thing that it's now a female who is 18 years and 6 months or whatever. Yeah, whatever the thing is. And I was like, he kind of looks that age.
Okay.
So the first time watching it, and I had to kind of remind myself this time that that's not the case. I thought she's now the youngest person. So they're trying to get her to a safe space.
Right.
So that she's not
like that attacked. Would kind of work as well. Right? Like, that's not that sort of out there, especially in this environment. But yes.
That's not the case. She's just pregnant.
It's not the case. So that first time that you watched it, were you as surprised as he was that she is pregnant?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Because they do a good job with the costumes and different things like that. And the way that they shoot her, that they never reveal the belly. And like, by the time he meets up with her, like, she's 8.5 months pregnant, 9 months pregnant. Yeah. Like, she's pregnant.
Yeah, she's right there. Yeah.
And so, like, they are trying to get her out of the country so that she can deliver in a safe space.
Well, some people are trying to get her
out of the country. Yeah, some people are trying to get her out of the country.
Not everybody.
We find that out in the safe house. But yeah, no, I was surprised too. Had you inklings the first time?
Well, yes, because I believe by the time I watched this for the first time, because I don't think I watched this in 2006, 2007. I probably watched a couple years later. I had tried to read the book.
Oh, okay.
And so I don't... I didn't finish the book because I found it quite tough to get into. But I don't think Key is in the book. I think it's a different character is pregnant.
Oh, okay.
But the whole idea of Clive Owen's character trying to help the first pregnant person to safety... That's the book.
Okay, and
I was kind of already primed for the fact that this is maybe where it was going to go. I think the reveal of her being pregnant is still like really good the way that they do it, because they kind of frame it and he assumes what's happening is that like she wants to have sex with him.
Yeah.
Because she like brings him to this barn and then she starts to undress and he's like, no.
Yeah, like I don't know what you think about me, but like we're not doing that.
We don't need to do any of this. But we, because it's focused on him, we're watching him react to her take her clothes off. And then he sees her belly and his look and his expression just completely changes. And we hold there for like a few seconds. So then you're sort of thinking like, well, like, what has happened here?
Yeah.
And then we go back and we see that she's clearly pregnant. And you're just like, oh my God. And then, yeah.
And then everybody rushes in and is like yelling at her for revealing the secret.
Yes. Yeah. They didn't want him to know because he's not really in the group.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And kind of her midwife, I guess. Yeah. I think she was a trained nurse, trained midwife. Yeah. is there kind of being like, no, Key wanted to tell him, like, this is her secret, this is her thing to share. She can tell whoever she wants to.
Well, she uses the line, which, of course, in 2006 was also quite an important line, but increasingly has gotten more so, where she's like, it's her body, it's her decision. And you're just like, oh, I know that one. I've heard that one before. So, yeah, I think maybe we'll save all the prescient stuff for the end. We'll keep going. But yes, anyways, they find out that the people who Key and Clive Owen's character thought were looking out for her are not actually looking out for her. They have their own plans for the baby. She doesn't want to do that. He doesn't want her to have to do that. So they go off on their own journey. So now they're being chased by the people who they thought they were working with.
Yeah.
And, you know, we don't have to go scene by scene by scene or whatever here, but they eventually end up at a refugee camp. And this is where shit gets real.
Yeah. Well, we did skip over the Michael Caine scene.
Well, I was going to save him maybe for...
Oh, okay. For his own little speech? Yeah, okay. Yeah. Okay, that's fine. But yeah, so we get to the refugee camp. We meet Sid, who only speaks about Sid in third...
Well, then you brought up Sid. So, but I would say there'd be like, God, I fucking love Michael Caine and Peter Mullen.
Oh, okay.
They're my two favorite characters of this movie because they're both unhinged in like completely different ways. So Michael Caine is Clive Owen's... I think they're supposed to just be best friends. I don't think they're actually related in any way. No. I think they were probably on the activist circuit 20 years ago, and they've just remained friendly.
I was trying to figure out if it was like Julianne Moore's parents or something.
No, but I don't think there's any relation. Like, I don't think there's any relation. Yeah. I think they're just friends. And so, yeah, we get a scene with him early in the movie where they're friendly and, you know, they have a good time together and all that sort of stuff. He's lives like a hermit, basically off in the woods with his comatose wife. And when Clive Owen is looking for a place to sort of regroup with Key and the midwife, he takes them there.
Yeah.
He takes them to this house. Michael Caine, like everybody else, it's one of my favorite things in the movie where like the baby, because it's been 18 years, the baby does trump
everything.
Everything.
Yeah.
And like, we'll get to that in the refugee camp because that's like the biggest part of it. But yeah, like as soon as he sees her and that she's pregnant, he is like,
come on in. I can keep you safe.
Over the fucking moon.
I've got a plan. Yeah. Give me a minute.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah,
I've got this.
How did you feel about his demise, his end? Because eventually the group do track them down to Michael Caine's house, and they make a sort of quick escape, but he decides to stay, mostly because I think his wife.
Yeah, so this time around, I knew things that were going to happen because I'd seen it before, and I then started to remember that I had seen it, but I couldn't remember how I got to some scenes, so I couldn't remember if Michael Caine left with them.
Right.
Or did he die or was he captured or something? And I was like, there was something with him and I couldn't quite remember. But once they all come back to the house and Clive Owen sees him working with poison, I was like, oh, the poison plays into this somehow. And like, I was trying to remember that storyline. So yes, him essentially poisoning his wife and his dog so that they aren't shot and killed. Well, so like,
I think he realizes that he's going to be killed.
Yeah.
And without him, the dog and the wife are going to slowly die.
Yeah.
And he doesn't want that. So he kills both of them quickly. Yeah. And like, it's kind of a nice way to go. Like, you know what I mean? Like, he's doing it in a loving way. He's doing, you know what I mean? If you turned to Chris today and said, would you kill me? It'd probably be a different situation. But, you know, in this way, it's a loving
moment for them. He puts on nice music.
Yes.
It's not a scary thing. It happens well before these other guys come in and kind of make it a bigger scary thing or whatever. So they die. He then goes outside. And for a moment there, I was just like, dude, does he send them the wrong way? And I was trying to remember it all again. And then they slowly start to kind of just shoot at him. And like, they shoot his hand.
He kind of annoys them to death.
Yeah, because like, he wants them to pull his finger. Yeah. Like,
yeah. He just like... Very irreverent, and he kind of just annoys them the fact that they just shoot him and he dies. And that's the end of Michael Caine.
Yeah. So I was sad because I also do enjoy him in this movie. I find if I was a person who had been living as a hermit for probably 18, 20 years, because you kind of, I think his wife was a photojournalist.
Yes.
Who had like broken stories. And
she was also an activist. And there's a little bit of like his sort of house is littered with newspaper clippings and photographs. And you sort of, they do linger on it enough that you can piece things together. And I think the storyline with the wife was that she was also a big time activist, and the government captured her, arrested her, whatever, and tortured her to the point of her
being semi-comatose.
Being a comatose. And like, she doesn't speak, she doesn't move, she doesn't interact in any way, but she is still alive.
Yeah.
And he cares for her.
And so for a brief moment, like, you do kind of want them to get out and see the world that is going to happen now that a new baby is born. But yeah, I also knew that that was not going to be the case, and he was going to die. So,
but he, yes, Michael Caine unfortunately does die. He's fantastic in this movie.
Yeah.
He's having a great time. He then leads us straight to Peter Mullen, who plays Sid, who is a police officer who likes to get high. And Michael Caine is a weed dealer, marijuana dealer. And so Peter Mullen as Sid just talks.
How about Sid?
Sid likes to do this, and Sid does that, and Sid doesn't really care what you guys are up to, but Sid will get you into the refugee camp. And I was just sitting there be like, Peter Mullen is the fucking man. I love this guy to bits.
I like love and hate him at the same time, because I love when people do the third person bit, but I think if he was in more of the movie, I would have been annoyed with the bit.
Oh, probably.
Because he's only there for such a short time. You are there just...
He has like two very brief scenes. Yeah.
And you are kind of just watching him being like, he probably is also going a bit nuts, having to deal with these refugees, having to bring people here, having people probably cry and yell at him and beg him to not bring them there.
Well, you understand why he wants drugs so much, that he's made best friends with a drug dealer, a hermit living drug dealer.
Yeah, I probably would go a little bit nuts too and start talking about myself in the third person.
But listen, he's still a cop and, you know, ACAB. Sid has a dark turn. A dark turn. There is a brief moment, and, you know, we can sort of, we'll walk through. So, like, Sid gets them into the refugee camp. They eventually find sort of a safe room for the night.
Yeah, the midwife is taken off the bus.
The midwife is taken off the bus. And probably killed.
Yeah.
But
now it's just Clive Owen and...
And Key.
Key.
The boat to the Human Project is coming the next day. And so they need a room for the night. And they find a room. Key goes into labor and she delivers a baby girl.
Yeah.
The next morning, Sid shows up. And did you think for a brief moment that Sid was actually going to help them? Or was the idea that Sid just like wanted to get them outside and then maybe take the baby or do, you know what I mean? Like, because there is, I think, a brief moment where he sees the kid for the first time and like everybody else is so shocked that it kind of, he doesn't know what to do. Like, he doesn't know how to react to the situation.
Well, when he first gets to the room, he doesn't know that there is a baby.
Yes.
Right? Like, he doesn't know that he was pregnant at this
one. He has no idea. Yeah.
So for that first moment when he first walks into the room, I did kind of think he was there to help. He was going to get them onto the boat or whatever. But then he sees the baby and he's like, oh, this is my card to play now. Like, if I have this baby,
true,
yeah, I can ask for anything.
Yeah.
And people will give me anything in the world. And so, yeah, I think it's when he sees the baby for me, it then turns into like him not wanting to be helpful.
He turns on them. Yeah. And they get away from Sid. And basically, like,
Sid comes in to tell them that the refugee camp is, somebody's blown a hole in the wall, not to get out,
but to get in.
Yeah. And he's just like, Not a good sign. Yeah. He's then reveals to them that their photos have been shared online on the news, on whatever.
Yeah, yeah.
And he now is there being like, actually, I can get you two and get some money. Like, this is even better, maybe. And I've got the baby.
And
the world was looking up for Sid in that brief moment. So
yeah, but the refugee camp has been completely turned into a war zone, and so the refugees have their own weapons, and they're fighting the police who are fighting the refugees. The group that originally had Key and Julianne Moore and whatnot, they're obviously the ones who blew the hole in the fence, they've come in to try and capture Key. They don't know she's delivered the baby, but they obviously know that she was pregnant to begin with. And it's basically like these three things all converge together on an apartment building that is just like
destroyed.
Like you're looking at the movie. I was just like, we've seen images like this now out of the Ukraine, out of Gaza, out of many, many war zones in the last 15 years. And you're just like, holy fuck. Like,
how does a little baby get out of this?
Well, no, I was just thinking, I was like, I think this movie is even more prescient now than it was 15 years ago when people were already sort of looking at it being like, yeah, the way that we're treating certain people around the world is not very far off from this. And 15 years later, it's like, oh no, that's exactly how we're treating them now.
Yeah.
Like, it sort of doesn't matter what part of the world it is. You know,
what time period we're in, we do this anytime.
We're doing this all the time. And I was just sort of like, holy fuck, like, it's almost a documentary at this point.
And I think that's where the last bit, when they are running through the town, because the rebel people, like Key's former allies, I guess, capture her, get her away with the baby. Clive Owen is about to be shot. Other people come in and shoot the people who are about to shoot him. Like, it gets a little messy. You kind of have to really keep track of the three groups.
Yeah, yeah. Who's where and what's going on.
And
yeah,
things like that. So you really have to focus on that for a little bit. But I find that that's the scene, and that's kind of the story bit here, where the camera does get really shaky. And I was sitting there being like, oh, it does feel like a documentary now. Like, the way that they are following people and following him around corners and things like that. I see that in documentaries that I'm watching.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
Like...
yeah, you, like... I think on my sort of review or whatever on Letterboxd, I was like, it's almost like watching the nightly news.
Yeah.
Because you're just like, I've just seen this imagery now hundreds of times over the last few years. And you're just like, oh my God. Like, obviously there had been war zones and there had been things before this movie had been made that Curran is probably pulling ideas out of, like, you know, the tank going down the street and bombing the shit out of this apartment block and whatnot. And, you know, the way that the concrete and the cement like flies off with like the flurry of gunfire. We'd seen that in other things before, but it really hit home the other night where I was like, oh, this is not fun at all. Like, this is not, holy shit. This would be like so scary, so terrifying. And it's exactly where Clive Owen needs to go. He needs to go right in the belly of it to get Key back with the baby.
But I love, and, like, I know it's the movie and it's written like that and stuff, but I love that, like, there's no hesitation on his part.
No.
Like,
no.
Once she's taken, he's just like, no, I've promised her that I'm going to get her safe and her baby safe. That's what I'm doing. And, like, follows after them. Like, everybody is shooting at you, Clive Owen. Maybe take a second. Take, like, that little beat of, like, huh, should I keep going? He doesn't do it. He just runs after her. And even when the apartment building is having like bazookas shot at it.
Yeah.
He's just like, nope, I'm going to go and follow this baby crying.
I think you get the sense too, like sometimes movies do that where it's like, there's a moment or whatever. And the character is like, oh, I've come too far. I can't turn back now. I might as well just sort of see it out. I think for Clive Owen's character, it's basically from the moment that she's pregnant.
Yeah.
Where he sees her pregnant, where I think you can see the switch go off on him. Where he's like, no, I'm going to do whatever I can to get her to safety with this baby. And like, by this stage, we knew he had a kid because I think you'd seen it in a photograph, but you didn't know what happened yet. And there's obviously all that sort of stuff. And until that point, he clearly just in it for the money. But yeah, I kind of like that it kind of went unspoken for him, where he's sort of like, he doesn't care that, you know, oh, maybe I could see my kid in your thing. It doesn't really matter to him. It's sort of, it's way more just, she's pregnant with a kid.
Yeah.
She needs to be safe. End of discussion. You know what I mean? Like, when they're having the debates and whatnot about what to do with her or how to get her out, and he's like, just get her a doctor. Like, she needs a doctor.
Yeah.
Because his whole thing is like, it doesn't really matter what happens with the kid as long as the kid is safe and healthy and she's safe and healthy.
Yeah.
So, yeah, kind of like you're saying there, where there was no hesitation. It was sort of like,
I think he had already had that moment.
There was no hesitation at sort of any point after he found out that she was pregnant. He was all in all the time. One of my favorite sort of moments in the movie, though, and I think this is probably exactly how it would play out, is during the fight, during the gun battle on the apartment block when he gets to Key and they start to leave and the baby is crying, everybody is stops. Just like overawed by what they are seeing. And like, people just want to take a look. People just want to like
touch the foot, touch whatever.
And
touch
like,
Key, yeah, touch anything.
Like, there's clearly, and there's obviously sort of like Messiah complex stuff going on. But I love like the soldiers come up the stairs and they're still firing guns. But then as soon as they see and hear the baby, they're like, fucking
ceasefire. Ceasefire.
Like,
yeah.
We need to cut this out right away. And it does become that thing of like, and maybe this goes back to like the moment with Sid and whatnot, where it's sort of like, they just don't know how to react.
No.
Nobody has sort of a nefarious, like, oh, I could grab the baby and no, because you're just like, what am I seeing right now?
Yeah.
Be like seeing an alien. And I just love that moment. Like, they just calmly walk out of this war zone and then they don't get 50 yards away before everyone's sort of like, okay, they're good. Like, let's start firing the guns again. And you're like, yeah, that's probably exactly how that would go. Somebody would see an opening to take a shot.
Somebody, I think it was from the apartment building, was just like, oh, I can't see them anymore. They must be safe.
They must
let's go shoot at these guys over here.
Yeah. These guys have let their guard down. I'm taking a shot. Yeah. And then all hell breaks loose again. And you're just like, that's probably exactly how that would all go.
And then they run into the gypsy woman, who I also love, because
she just wanted to save the dog.
She wanted to save her dog. Yeah. And I was like, rightly so, save the dog. But I love that, like, she doesn't speak English.
No.
And so it is kind of through miming and hopeful gestures that she is trying to get them to a safe space.
To the boat.
to the boat. Yeah. And you're just like, well done, woman. And like, they try and get her on the boat and she's like, nope, I'm good.
But like, they get on the boat, they get to the meeting place. They have to wait a while.
Clive Owen's been shot.
He doesn't make it, but the boat does show up.
Do you think he dies?
Oh yes, he definitely dies.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, he definitely dies.
I had a little hope that maybe he doesn't die.
No, he definitely dies. He definitely does. I think it's like, it's fine for him to die because ultimately he saved this baby. He didn't get to save his baby, but he saved this baby. And I think that's fine. He dies. And the movie ends on maybe the only moment of hope because you hear children laughing in the background.
Oh, yes. You do, don't you?
Yes. And you're sort of like, okay, maybe we made it through. But they don't show you anything. You just hear it.
And I think I had seen somewhere when I put in Children of Men online to pull up something. I'm going to say his name wrong. Alfonso.
Cuarón.
Kind of said he wanted to make a movie where the ending was almost the beginning of another movie.
Yeah, you
can
see
it. And I was like, oh, I totally see that. Yep. Because if it doesn't warrant it, and I almost wouldn't enjoy it, but if he had come out with like a Children of Men 2, where you get to see Key and the baby on the Tomorrow Boat and with the Human Project, it would be a completely different story than what this story is.
Oh, yeah.
But I kind of like that it's never been told because I kind of just make it up in my head of like,
like, what's the, I don't know. Yeah. Like, what's the story? Like, they have kids and humanity saved? Boring. Who cares about that? So just before we sort of wrap it all up here, was there a favorite, or maybe favorite is definitely maybe the wrong word to use, but like a set piece that stood out to you on the second time through where you sort of knew what was coming, but you're still like, that still wowed me. That still really sort of blew my hair back a little.
Probably the last.
The refugee camp.
The refugee camp. And I think it's just because like I'm in that moment with them. I'm following them every time and stuff. So yeah, that's probably me.
I think for me, it's still the car.
Really?
It's still the car because we go from sort of calm and fun.
Happy-go-lucky
to like terrifyingly scared within seconds. And I think he sells it. You know what I mean? Like, he sets it up really well. And yeah, from that point on, it just like piles on. It just gets bleaker and bleaker. And then is there a moment in the movie where you're just like, that is a horrifying look at our potential future? Like what's an image that stands out in your mind of a like, Jesus Christ, if we get there, we've gone too far.
See, and I think it's because this has already happened, but like having all of the immigrants in cages, like we're already there. We already do that. It's happened down in the States, I know. So yeah, that's probably my thing. I would love for us to not do that, but I don't know how much me saying that on the podcast will influence the world.
You never know. Joe Biden might be one of our listeners. If now only we could get Donald Trump to be another listener, we'd have, you know what I mean? I don't know if that's going to happen.
No. What about, do you have kind of a moment or something?
An image that would terrify me of the future? Yeah. Charlie Hunnam in dreads. Okay. If we get there, we've gone too far as humanity. There's no coming back.
I started with a joke, I'm going to end with a joke. I thought you weren't going to make any more jokes.
Started with a joke, ending with a joke. So we can wrap up children and men. I think both of us come down on the same page, obviously, that extremely good movie, very tough watch.
Yeah. Yeah. It's not the yearly rewatch kind of movie. No.
But so, like, you sort of like, anyone who hasn't seen this.
Definitely should.
Yeah. Do yourself a favor. It's tough. It's not very fun.
No.
But like, it's a damn good movie. And like, I think it'd be interesting to watch this again in another few years to sort of be like, are we getting closer to Children of Men?
Yeah.
Or are we getting further away
from Children of Men? Have we learned from this?
Yeah. Because I feel like right now we're on a dead set path towards this.
Yeah, me too.
Do you want to tease next week?
It's a sequel.
We're doing another sequel.
Sequel and a trilogy.
Yep. It's my favorite of the trilogy.
Is it?
Yeah.
I can't remember now which one I said was my favorite. I have to go back and look at them again.
This is my favorite of the three. Of the original three, anyways.
The original three, yeah. But one of our favorite series. Yeah. One of our favorite trilogies.
A pretty easy go-to.
Yeah.
I did say to you when we were sort of planning the next couple weeks out, I was like, you need to pick one maybe that you've seen before that you enjoy, because I feel like there'd been a lot of first-time watches in a row. This week, we weren't really sure, but Children
I couldn't remember.
You couldn't really remember. And I think I also did say to you that, like, maybe make it a happy one. And you still chose this movie that we're doing next week, which I was like, all right, cool.
Well, I would like to point out, I tried to put in some animated movies and they
I'm not ready for that.
Got vetoed real quick.
Yeah, I'm not ready for that.
And then Kieran and I have set ourselves a challenge to read a book.
And do the movie.
And then do the movie. Yeah. So that'll
maybe 2-3 weeks from now?
Yeah.
Do you think like you could do that in 2-3 weeks?
Yeah. I need to start the book, but yeah.
You failed the last one. So if you
failed, I did not fail it. I've eventually finished the book.
Not in time for the podcast.
Just not for the podcast.
Yeah, not for the episode, which was the whole point. So yeah, if you don't do it again this time, I guess that's just
par for the course.
Yeah, tradition at this point. But yeah, next week, a sequel to a movie. Like we did the first one last year. So
yeah.
Yeah. Until then, we'll see everybody next week.
See you then.